Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why the WNBA Players Union opted out of its CBA a day after the league finals, and how a local band decided to pay tribute to its former lead singer. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The United States is now an occupied country, but it will soon be an occupied country no longer.
The Republicans are geniuses at sowing doubt and division. This woman's an alien. Trump's called her every name in the book, including a communist.
Bottom line, Peggy decided what was best for her. Like, this puts it in the end. I mean, it's basically akin to a jaywalking conviction and a $500 fine. So it's over.
We want people to understand that if they're going to engage in any inappropriate behavior at the vote center or at the tabulation center, it will be dealt with, period.
We spent a lot of time talking to folks in Wilcox, and as you know, I was committed to working something out in the legislature. I'm still hopeful that that can happen, but this action was important to protect the folks in Wilcox.
And joining me to talk about all the political visitors we've had in Arizona this week, a Cochise County supervisor taking a plea deal in the case surrounding her delay in certifying the 2022 election and more, our Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good morning. I can't believe I can even fit in the studio with all the politicos who are walking through here.
Absolutely. And we're also joined by former state lawmaker Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good to see you too.
Great seeing you as well.
All right, so let's talk about all the frequent flyer miles that candidates and surrogates and campaigns are getting traveling to Phoenix. We've had vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, former President Bill Clinton, former President Trump, Joe Biden, the president, will be here today. Tim Walz will be here on Saturday. Donald Trump Jr. was here this week. Reginald, I guess this is just further proof that Arizona is important to both campaigns.
Absolutely. Arizona is in play. I mean, when you look at, you know, polling data, and I think folks are, you know, starting to say we feel like Arizona is trending toward Trump. But then you start to see an onslaught of Trump surrogates. You see Harris surrogates, you see momentum that is bubbling out, and you see ballot returns. I think absolutely Arizona's in play. And, you know, both of these candidates, they have Arizona circled on their map. And, you know, obviously they have different pathways to victory. But, you know, Arizona provides a backdoor strategy for both campaigns.
Is this sort of a rally the base kind of move? Like, are any of these people coming here bringing out maybe undecided voters or, you know, sort of the new voter, low propensity voter?
You know, it's funny you should say that. I actually was at the Vance rally for a whole nother reason. And I talked to a reporter, a national reporter, who said he actually found an undecided voter in that crowd at the Vance rally in Peoria at Tier Tactical. He actually found an undecided. The husband was decided and he was a Trump voter, but the wife hadn't yet decided. She was still listening. So, which surprised me. If you're going to go to a Vance rally, you might as well, you know, be a Trump supporter, right? But look, they don't need the candidates don't necessarily need to rally the base. They need to touch the people in the middle, and there's definite enthusiasm on both sides here. Trump is bringing in big crowds, and so is Harris and all the surrogates, right? I mean, the Vance rally I attended, while a small place, a Tier Tactical, you know, only a few hundred people, still was overflow, right? Mm-hmm. People were turned away. So people are excited about, this race, and we'll see over probably 80% engagement this cycle.
But how many people are there, do you think, in the middle? Like, there was that one person at the Vance rally who was undecided. Mm-hmm. Like, is that the only person left in the state who's undecided at this point?
Honestly, I mean, this is not going to be a popular opinion, but I say if you're undecided, maybe sit this one out.
Wow.
I mean, what is there not? What more will it take for you to decide after 9 years of Trump? We know exactly who, even if you don't know a lot about Harris, either you love Trump or you hate Trump. There really isn't much of a middle ground when it comes to him. So what is there to really decide if you are undecided? What's going to be the tipping point?
Reginald, we've heard so much about how the Harris campaign is still sort of in this. I mean, it's been obviously a very condensed campaign because she got in less than 100 days ago, but that there's still the usually at this point, you know, candidates are in the get out the vote mode, in the like rally the base, get them to vote. But she's still kind of in that persuasion mode. Do you think that there is some persuasion left to do in Arizona? Like, are there people who are not decided yet? Maybe they don't like Trump and aren't quite sold on her, that having former President Clinton, having Tim Walz here, if she comes back, could make a difference.
I think so. You know, I mean, look, there are individuals who are still trying to understand and who Kamala Harris is, you know. I think she's laid out, you know, really strong policy plans. And I just want to first say, I think she's being held to a totally different standard than Trump. You know, he has all of these, half-baked policies that he's trying to form, where she's like being required to come out with real substantive policies, which she's doing. And I do think that right now, you know, the folks who are deciding whether or not they're going to vote for Harris, they're trying to get more policy information, which she's delivering upon. But I my hope, though, is that at the end of the day, you're asking yourself, you know, where do you want this country to go? I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that over the last 10 years that you've seen a more polarized environment. You can't sit down, you know, with your coworker and have conversations about politics. And you liken that directly to, you know, Trump's candidacy and him serving as president. And I think folks are ready to really move past that.
I mean, I will say in my 53 years on this planet, I have never seen a more polarized group of people, that when someone is wearing a red MAGA hat, you know, a Democrat will just, you know, left-leaning person might look at that person and just think idiot, right? Mm-hmm. And vice versa. When a Republican might see someone, you know, wearing a Kamala hat or talking about some liberal positions, they will just think of that person as a bad person. And it is a shame that we can't, I yearn for the days, if you will, of George Bush and even, you know, Bill Clinton, where at least we could have conversations about the peccadilloes that each of them had and the policy differences that were out there without hating the person that you're talking to.
Yeah, kind of hard to believe that was actually a thing in this country at this point.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about a couple of polls that came out. Obviously, polls, snapshots in time, and, you know, there's all sorts of warnings about don't really listen to the polls, especially as you get this close to the election, because votes have been cast. They're, you know, votes are already in the bank. But there are two that were pretty interesting. One from a High Ground local firm showed that Trump was leading Harris 46.8% to 46.2%. A Marist poll found Trump leading Harris 50 to 49. So both basically within a point of each other. But significantly, you know, we've seen polls all over the place. We've seen Harris up by a couple. We've seen Trump up by a couple. Is this surprising to you that it's this narrow, this close to the election, Reginald?
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at, you know, 4 years ago, you know, the race was decided by less than 11,000 votes. I'm a strong believer that if the Harris campaign and those who are working to elect, Vice President Harris, if they can turn out the base, if they can turn out individuals who, you know, really believe in Harris and her policy, I think Arizona, you know, goes for Harris. But if they can't, you know, if that doesn't happen, then I do think that, you know, election night could be a long one.
You know, you got to remember, even in 2016, when Trump won the state, he did not reach 50%. He's yet to get to 50% in the state. However, that all being said, I think it's Harris who has the greater headwinds here in Arizona. You know, you kind of want to talk about the economy and illegal immigration. Those are the two things that are top of mind for voters. And voters remember 4 or 5 years ago that they could buy a house at 3%, maybe even sub 3% interest rate, where they could afford the mortgage payment. Today, it's really difficult to move in this town. In the Phoenix area. Remember, Phoenix had the highest inflation of all the country. And that was right here in the Phoenix MSA. People remember that. And rightly or wrongly, they're going to blame the Democratic administration. And they're going to remember what it was like under Trump. Most people do not remember tweets or, you know, kind of how they felt when, you know, Trump would say something crazy. They didn't pay attention to that.
Even with sort of the quantity of the tweets and the statements. I mean, this is, as you said, you know, people either love Trump or hate him. Most of them anyway, not everybody,
right.
But most people either love him or hate him. And for a lot of people who don't like him, it's because of the tweets. It's because of, mm-hmm. you know, calling people low IQ or like calling them names,
sure.
and the derogatory and frankly, just mean things he says about them.
But look, you know, Mark, obviously the listeners here in KJZZ are very well-informed people, but there's a lot of low information voters, people who get home from work, they got to get their kids ready for volleyball practice, and they got to make dinner, then they got to, you know, pay bills, find some time to relax and watch The Bachelor. You know, they are too busy.
Are you describing your Tuesday night?
It's neither here nor there. people are kind of busy to watch CNN all day long or, you know, the couple hours at night. And so you are relying on all voters knowing that Trump likes Hitler's generals, right? Like that hasn't necessarily seeped in to the broader electorate. Sure, again, people who watch CNN or MSNBC, they're here or listen to KJZZ, absolutely they're hearing that. But that's not everyone, right? That is not a majority of voters.
So, Reginald, as Barrett said, he thinks that Vice President Harris has the stronger headwinds here. And obviously, when you're thinking about the border and you're thinking about the economy, which a lot of voters are thinking about, polls have shown that more people think former President Trump will do a better job on those. So if you're the Harris campaign, how do you try to overcome that?
I mean, I think you actually, you know, describe what it was like when Donald Trump was president. I mean, to be completely transparent, Donald Trump came in, you know, riding off the coattails of President Barack Obama's economy, you know, and then when you look at the last year or so of the Trump, you know, presidency, I mean, the economy was essentially falling apart. And obviously, you know, he'll have COVID and other things, you know, that played a factor there.
It wasn't COVID and other things. It was COVID. I don't think voters blame Trump for COVID.
They might not. But I do think the reality is Trump came in and he talked about immigration being a primary central issue when he ran for office. He was there for 4 years. He didn't do anything about it. You know, Trump, you know,
I would say there's a part of a wall that shows he did something.
And we also know that, you know, he said Mexico was going to pay for it. They didn't pay a penny. You know, and then you also had this idea that, you know, he was going to provide, you know, jobs and opportunities for minority communities. It didn't happen. So you remind people of actually what Trump was saying back in 2020, 2016, and ask, did he deliver? And ultimately, he didn't.
Right. And here's the problem with some Democrats. They are denying reality. As Red should know, Trump is getting a higher percentage of the African-American vote and the Latino vote than almost any Republican in the past.
That's 100% question, but it depends on what polls that you're looking at, right?
Because I look at the New York Times. I look at almost every poll.
But you got to look at the crosstabs, and you have to look at pollsters who actually spend time polling in the African American community. And what you ultimately see is that 10 years ago and today, there's no significant difference when you talk about statistical issues with regards to black men or Latino men who are voting for Trump.
I think you see it here in Arizona with Carrie Lake and Donald Trump, that Trump is, you know, leading or tied with Harris, and Lake is way down. I think that's a lot of because of the Hispanic community, Hispanic men.
I want to push back on that because I think ultimately, you know, once you see every election cycle, is you have folks who say, well, if Harris wins, then it was, you know, white middle class women, swing voters who delivered the victory. But if Harris or a Democrat loses, you know, Hispanic and black men, we can't have it both ways. The reality is when you look at the cross numbers and posters, the reason why Trump is doing much better is because you see, you know, white women in suburban communities, they're not directly lining up behind Harris the way that they did for Biden. So we can't have it both ways. It can't be swing voters delivered when Democrats win, but then if Democrats lose, it's minority voters.
All right, guys, we got to take a quick break. That's Reginald Boulding. I'm also joined by Barrett Marson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former state lawmaker Reginald Boulding and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Barrett, let me start with you on Cochise County Supervisor Peggy Judge. She was, of course, indicted for her role in the 2022 election, basically did not want to certify the election in Cochise County and only did so after a judge said, you have to do this. She pled guilty to a misdemeanor in her role for that. We heard at the top, basically like a $500 fine and some probation. I'm curious what you make of this particular move in this case.
I mean, settled for $500, a felony that is now knocked down to barely a misdemeanor, right? Barely jaywalking, as her lawyer noted at the top of the show. I never could figure out why this was a felony to begin with. I got my law degree from Law and Order University, so but I really could not figure out how this was a felony, and especially because she eventually did indeed certify the election, whether a judge told her or whatever. She actually did it. So I never understood why this was a felony and, you know, knocked down to, you know, just a misdemeanor that will have zero impact on her life.
Do you think this says anything about what might happen to Tom Crosby, who is the other supervisor who didn't want to certify the election, who ultimately didn't?
Right.
Again, from your Law and Order University.
If I were him, I would go, hey, I want the same deal she got because, you know, here's a couple of $100 and, you know, go have a good time out on the town. You know, I think that he probably is I'm going to guess the attorney general will go a little bit harder on him because he did not vote.
Mm-hmm.
The board voted, but he did not vote.
Right.
He just skipped that meeting.
He didn't show up.
He didn't show up. So, I mean, I never really thought these were felonies, but I'm not really in the business of defending these two.
Reginald, I mean, the attorney general's office has said, you know, we want to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again in terms of a county supervisor not doing what they are required to do in terms of certifying the election. Does this send that message that it's a misdemeanor knockdown, you know, a couple $100 fine?
Well, I think we have to see, you know, watch everything play out. I think this is classic of, you know, who comes to the table first and pleads, you know, they get the better deal. And I think you'll see that in the fake elector case as well, right? So, you know, she came, she pled guilty, you know, saved the attorney general's office resources, saved the court resources, so she got the better deal. But ultimately, I think the headline here is that, you know, for folks who, you know, take an oath to office, if you're, you know, an election official, you know, you have to do the job, right? You know, you're put there to do the job, and just to say that you're not because of, you know, some emotional pull that you have with what's happening in the political scene, it just can't happen. So I think the attorney general, you know, she made the case, she got the conviction, and, you know, hopefully it deters in the future.
Yeah. And look, I think they should absolutely be certifying these elections. There certainly was nothing wrong in Cochise County or any part of Arizona. But at the end of the day, they did.
Well, one of them did.
Well, but the board.
The board did.
The board certified. And that's the important part.
Okay. So we saw this week, guys, a couple of fairly scary stories in terms of the police were able to arrest the guy who had shot up the DNC office in Tempe a few times. He was also witnessed putting up bags of white powder on campaign signs. We saw some mysterious powder that fortunately turned out to be nothing sent to Carrie Lake's, one of her campaign offices. There's so much talk about the threat of political violence. We saw it a few years ago with the threats of political violence and actual political violence. Is this, Reginald, do you think, a harbinger of what we can expect leading up to and maybe after November 5th?
You know, I really hope not. I mean, I truly believe that, you know, our democracy is only as safe as the safety of every voter, right? Whether we're talking about, you know, poll workers, we're talking about folks in the community going to, you know, the ballot box, you know, so we have to really, and I think this is where elected officials, you know, really have to step up and say, look, we may disagree with the other side and we may have fundamentally, you know, issues that, like, even, you know, deep beliefs, you know, that we disagree with, but we are not going to let that lead to violence. And, you know, the fact of the matter is when you have these issues take place, when you hear silence, you know, from elected officials, they don't speak about these issues, it kind of seems like they're acquiescing to what's happening. But, you know, my hope is that Arizona doesn't end up as a national headline because something, you know, disastrous happened.
Who specifically would you like to hear from in this case?
You know, I think everyone, you know, Republicans, Democrats, I'd like to see a unity statement, right? You know, for them, you know, the caucuses in the legislature, you know, high profile Republicans and Democrats come together to say, look, at the end of the day, we're going to have an election here. One side's going to win, one side's not. But the safety of our community is the most important thing. And if they could do it before the election, that would be great.
Yeah, the these threats and actual political violence really has, you know, got to stop. Obviously, you know, there is a bit of a history. You know, you've had two Kennedys who were assassinated. There was an attempt on George Wallace's life. I mean, you know,
a couple attempts on former President Trump's life.
Right. And so, but I'm saying that it's not new, but we do have to absolutely find a way. Politicians have to find a way to bring down the temperature. And unfortunately, that is not how they're rewarded by the media, if you will. I mean, the media likes incendiary comments, but then again, they decry any political violence. And I do think both sides need to take down that temperature, you know, because it has gotten out of hand.
Do you think it would be possible? I'm just going to two candidates because they're the top of the ticket in Arizona. Do you think it would even be conceivable that, for example, Ruben Gallego and Carrie Lake would put out a joint statement and say, hey, look, we disagree on virtually everything, but the thing we do agree on is that you shouldn't be shooting up campaign offices. You shouldn't be sending potentially dangerous substances to campaign offices.
Well, you would need at least one of them to start the conversation and be the bigger person. I'm not really sure either of them want to be the bigger person when it comes to the other. So I don't see that ever happening. But it would be nice if some political leaders came out who are strong in both communities, if you will, Carrie Lake types or Ruben Gallego types, to come out and bring down the temperature. It would be nice to see that. I'm not holding my breath.
So as the one former elected official in the room, what would it take for elected officials or candidates to actually do that?
I mean, you know, courage, right? I mean, but, you know, elected officials many times take courage in them not being on the ballot, you know, the problem is right now, and it's become so polarized that, you know, folks in both bases, you know, they don't reward folks for having that courage. And, you know, I think that's ultimately a problem. You know, my hope is that, you know, that you see it at some point, you know, and you know, that's when we'll start to see the change in tide.
All right, so we have just about a minute or so left, and we mentioned the polls a little bit earlier, but we didn't talk about the results in the Senate race. And Barrett, you alluded to the fact that Carrie Lake has been down in most of the public polls anyway, and both the High Ground and the Marist polls basically found the same thing, that Carrie Lake was down roughly, let's say, 7 to 9 points between those polls. Do you think the margin is going to be that big when all the votes are counted?
Yes, I have been saying for a while that I believe it's 7 to 10 points.
Really?
Easy. And, you know, Carrie Lake has really turned off a lot of people from independents to Republicans. She is not running nearly as strong as President Trump, former President Trump, in these polls. And there's a reason for that. She has, I think, alienated a lot of even Republican voters who are upset with her over some of the things that she has done since she lost the governor's race.
All right, Reginald, just about 20 seconds left. Do you think the margin is ultimately going to be that big?
I'm not sure if it's going to be that big. I do think Ruben wins, you know, definitely outside of the margin of error. But, yeah, 7 to 10 is huge. I mean, if he wins that, that's ultimately great for him. And I think, you know, even looking down the line, if you're someone like, you know, Katie Hobbs, you'd be really excited about that and what that could potentially mean, you know, for you in 2026.
I went and saw Aerosmith not that long ago, and so Dream On is in my head.
Oh, jeez. All right. That is Barrett Marson, Reginald Bolden. Guys, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a Phoenix-based band is back with a new album after the loss of their lead singer. But first, the WNBA Players Union this week opted out of their collective bargaining agreement with the league. That came a day after the deciding game of the WNBA Finals and at the end of a year that saw increases in both attendance and TV ratings. The players say they want higher salaries and other benefits. With me to talk more about this is Cassandra Negley, who covers women's basketball for Yahoo Sports. Cassandra, good morning.
Good morning.
So was it a surprise that the Players Union took this step?
It was not a surprise at all. For really the past year, they've been pretty open that players wanted to opt out and renegotiate a lot of pieces of this, what was a historic CBA in 2020.
So what specifically are they asking for?
Well, there were a few things that they named in their release announcing this. A new economic model to start. They had mentioned the salary cap. A lot of teams are finding other ways to support their players outside of that cap. And it sounds like they want to, you know, make that allowable instead of punishing it or investigating it. As you mentioned, player salaries, they're always looking for more money. Business is booming in the WNBA, and they're also looking at bonuses, things like pensions, and then a minimum professional standard. So you're seeing practice facilities like the one in Phoenix popping up all around the league. Mm-hmm. They want things like that to be regularly provided at this high professional level.
I want to ask you about the timing of this, because as you alluded to and as I mentioned, this was a pretty historic year for the WNBA in terms of attendance and TV ratings and just general attention with, you know, players like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and, you know, a really interesting and fun to watch WNBA finals and, you know, a series before that between two of the better teams in the league, the Liberty and the Aces. How significant is the timing of this opt-out relative to where the league is at this moment?
The timing of the opt-out was always set because of the CBA, but it is certainly beneficial for the players that it comes at this time for all the things that you just mentioned. I mean, especially because they also signed that media rights deal earlier in the year. So the players know that there is going to be a lot of money coming into the league. It's just kind of a perfect storm. They had until November 1st to opt out, and they will have until next October to negotiate a new deal.
Yeah, you mentioned the TV deal. Both the NBA and WNBA signed new TV and streaming deals. And as you say, that's a lot of money coming into the league. That also seems like it kind of played into the advantageous timing for the players to have this time to opt out.
Yeah, to know that money is coming in, you know, that's really where player salaries rise in all of these professional leagues, is when you can get more and more money from a media deal. That's where it spreads down into things like the salary cap. So that's at the top of players' list. But they also just want to be, you know, from conversations that we've all had with players, they also want to be more involved. They want to reap the benefits that you're seeing from the media rights deal, the TV viewership, the social media interest, everything that has happened this year that's really just increased past, I think, what anyone thought it could within 2 years.
There has been so much attention on the fact that a lot of WNBA players choose to or need to play abroad in the offseason because they just don't make enough money in the WNBA to, you know, they just don't make enough money. That was especially the case after the Brittany Griner situation where she was wrongfully detained in Russia. Is that a goal of the players' union to make it so that, you know, these players can play the WNBA season and not have to play elsewhere at another time unless they really want to?
Yes, absolutely. They want to make it so that if you're going overseas to play, it's because you want to. There are some players who, especially younger players, who go overseas to work on a specific skill or increase a part of their game so that they can come home and latch onto a team. But if you don't want to do that, the union doesn't want you to have to do that. Part of that will also be the prioritization clause that players kind of had to agree to in the last CBA. That's what owners really wanted, and it requires players to be in training camp on time at the start of the season, which impacts their ability to play overseas. Mm. That will be a part of that negotiation.
So what has the league, what have the owners been saying about this? I mean, does it seem as though they're up for negotiating some of this?
It does seem like both sides are willing to negotiate in good faith and come to an agreement for things that everyone wants. You know, there are also a lot of new owners in the league over the past 4, 5, 6 years who weren't involved in all of those other CBAs. And there are owners coming into the WNBA who want kind of the bigger picture, same things that players want, right? Like places like Phoenix and Las Vegas have opened facilities they want to provide for the players. So I do think it will be done in good faith.
Do you think it will be done? You say you think it'll be done in good faith. Do you think it will be done in time for the next season to start on time?
That, I think, we will see. Players, the union, according to sources, is saying that it's willing to go and do a work stoppage if they don't come to an agreement. Last time that the CBA came around, I believe they extended the deadline. I do hope it will be done. But I think also the WNBA is at a point it's never been at where if there is a work stoppage, it won't impact them as deeply as it would have before. And the players probably know that.
Interesting. All right. That is Cassandra Negley, covers women's basketball for Yahoo Sports. Cassandra, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. According to the U.S. Census, the number of people who self-identify as Native American has more than doubled in the last 20 years. But at the same time, the number of people actually enrolled in tribes is much lower than it used to be. In her new book, Indian Card, Carrie Schutpeltz uncovers the history behind that phenomenon. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it, beginning with how people with Native American descent in America have to prove their identity.
Every tribe is different. Some tribes in the country use a lineage-based system. And so in order to enroll, a person needs to prove that they are a direct descendant from someone on the tribe's rolls.
Okay.
And the rolls can be from any point in time. It is a roll that the tribe has decided to use. There are tribes that use rolls from within the last decade and tribes that use rolls from the early 1900s. The majority of tribes, though, actually use what we call blood quantum. And blood quantum is sort of a mathematical calculation of identity. How much blood does a person have from that particular tribe?
Mm-hmm.
It's not how much native blood a person has, but rather how much blood from that one specific tribe.
How do you prove that?
Well, you prove it in similar ways in terms of descendancy, okay. Right? And so if I have a grandparent who was enrolled in my tribe and their blood quantum is written as 4/4 or 100% on okay. that tribe's rolls, then I am at the very least 1/4.
Wow. Okay. So you delve into the history of this kind of process and these different ways of doing this in the book. Talk about where this comes from, like who designed these kinds of, you know, requirements to prove, you know, blood quantum or something like that.
Well, it wasn't the tribes.
Right.
These systems, you know, the idea of enrollment, the idea of written and formal membership, these are not native concepts. The U.S. federal government began making lists of Native people as early as, you know, the first couple decades of the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, it was so that they could divvy up treaty money. List making became more and more of a common sort of idea as Indian removal happened. And so Native tribes were sent to reservations far from where their ancestral lands were. And that really was to make sure that the federal government had sort of rounded them up and, you know, accounted for everybody.
Wow.
And then moving into the late 1800s, we had sort of an epic failure of Native policy, which was the Dawes Act or the General Allotment Act. And this really was the tipping point of list making. This was when the federal government said to tribes, we're going to take your land, we are going to divide it up and divvy it up to your members individually. This was an attempt by the government to not only strip tribes of power, but also to encourage / force Native people into plot farming.
Mm. So this goes a long way back and has kind of a fraught history. Tell us about your own story here. Like, you did this yourself, kind of going through this process. Tell us what drove you to do that, what you learned.
Yeah, I mean, one of the questions I've been asking myself for a while now is, how did we get here? how did we arrive at a place where I have a small laminated card in my wallet that says I am a member of the Lumbee tribe, which is my tribe? Certainly, this wasn't something my ancestors were doing 200 years ago. They weren't churning out cards.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the research began as personal curiosity, frankly. But as that journey continued, I actually started to connect it back to this idea of identity more broadly. I also happened to have a couple of kids mm-hmm. during the process of writing this book. And I think that once you have kids, these ideas of identity for yourself also sort of snowball into ideas of identity for them. And so it sort of became more of a story of me and my own journey and the journeys of the women who I interviewed as part of the book with this kind of historical landscape in the background.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, I mean, you're grappling with this idea of why you did it. You wrote this really interesting quote I want to read. You wrote that the one quarter of Indian, quote unquote, blood that I possess could just as easily be stated as the reverse equation. I am three quarters German, too. Tell us what you mean by that and how this kind of idea gets at this bigger question that you're talking about of identity in general.
You know, I have always sort of walked around thinking I wasn't native enough. Mm. I grew up 1,000 miles away from my tribe. I grew up in Iowa. My tribe is located in North Carolina. I was not surrounded by a Lumbee community other than my immediate family members. I don't know that I present as native looking, whatever that means, you know, based on the stereotypes that we society have. Mm-hmm. And so I always sort of felt almost like an imposter. And unfortunately, blood quantum has gotten wrapped up into that. It's not uncommon for a Native person to be asked by complete strangers how Indian they are. And so I think that it's impossible not to let that stuff seep into your own thoughts about identity, right? And if you're more, quote unquote, of one thing than you are of another, well, then what does that mean? I think we've reached a point in this country where everybody carries around multiple identities. And so I think that a lot of people probably walk around thinking, well, am I enough of X, Y, and Z to call myself X, Y, and Z? And so that has always been a theme of my life. And honestly, what was really fascinating was when I began to grapple with these questions, I started noticing that other people were too.
So I want to ask you lastly about something that you wrote here about why you think people do this, why maybe you wanted to do this, that you think it's maybe unique to Native people, this need to constantly prove that identity. Where do you think that comes from?
I can tell you that it probably started with federal policy. You know, throughout the last 200 years, particularly with list making and this identity of membership, the federal government has attempted to assimilate Native people into the broader society with the idea of shrinking the amount of quote unquote Indian they are. Mm-hmm. You know, during the Dawes Act, when a person would get their plot of land from the government, eventually they would receive a title to the land if they were less than one half Indian. Once you reached one half Indian or less, you were deemed competent. And in other words, a part of American society.
Wow.
And so there's always been this sort of strange cutoff that the federal government has used to say you are Indian and you are not.
Right. All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Carrie Schutpeltz, Associate Professor and Director of the Native Policy Lab at the University of Iowa. Her new book is The Indian Card, Who Gets to Be Native in America? Carrie, thanks for coming on. Thanks for talking to us about this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Back in 2022, the Phoenix-based band Catastro was in California working on songs for a new album. And then tragedy struck. Their lead singer, Andy Chavez, was killed in a car accident. The group, which had been together for 15 years at that point, found themselves at an agonizing crossroads. They'd lost one of their best friends, and finishing the album seemed unthinkable. But 2 years later, against all odds, the album is complete. It's called Until the End of Time, and they released it earlier this month with Chavez on vocals. To make it work, Catastro had to completely reinvent their songwriting process. The show's Sam Dingman spoke with bassist Ryan Weddle.
So generally, you know, our songs would always start music first. And then usually at the very, very last minute in typical Andy fashion, he would like write the lyrics in the studio when it was time to record them. And he would record these rough takes where it was just all gibberish, and we would change. You'd find the vowels that fit the best on the right beats or whatever. And so that's kind of how it would start. And then at the last minute, we'd fill in the words and we'd find the words that fit the consonants and vowels perfectly to the way that we had envisioned it. And so when we were, you know, in California on those last sessions, a lot of these tracks that ended up becoming our final album, like most of what we were left with was gibberish and, you know, lines that didn't make sense, things that weren't completed. And that was a challenge. To complete this album, we had to reverse the way that we've always done things for the last, you know, 17 years of being in a band. And we had to write music backwards, you know.
I mean, this is fascinating to me because we're very familiar with the story of a band where the lead singer is on some kind of big ego trip. And it's all about, you know, I got a vision for these lyrics and you guys just have to follow me. And what I hear you saying is that the words really had to earn their place in the songs.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always felt, you know, just when I'm listening as an enjoyer of music, the first thing that grabs me is the music. And so regardless of how meaningful your lyrics are, if it's not over the right landscape, it's going to fall flat to me. And, you know, I know not all people are like that, but I think that that's just kind of how we had always done it until he had passed away. And then that's how it happened, was we had to find our way to make what he was saying make sense.
Yeah, well, so that brings us to the new record. Obviously, on the record, there are words and lyrics, not just gibberish. So how did you get there? Where do those recordings of his voice come from?
I believe when we left that studio in California, I think we came home with 4 or 5 rough ideas. So we maybe would have the chorus lyrics recorded. But these were what we call scratch recordings. So it's just, hey, Andy, go in there, do a couple takes, and then we'll move on, just so that we don't forget it, you know? We were planning, you know, when we got back to Arizona, to go to our studio in Tempe here and have him, like, really work out some of the words or some of the melodies or whatever. But we just wanted placeholders.
So these, just to make sure I understand, these were, you had reached the point where he had attached specific words to what was previously gibberish, but they were sort of, they were rough recordings of the lyrics.
Kind of, yeah. So, for instance, like, one of the songs when we came back, I believe, is called Good Time. That one, we had lyrics in the chorus were done, but nothing else was really completed. And so we had had all the music ideas for, like, verses and maybe a bridge or, you know, we kind of knew where we could go with some of that. But we just had, you know, this one line from Andy. It was a lot of digging through old hard drives, and we'd found songs that we had started for previous albums that were the same kind of thing, where he would, you know, say a handful of lines and then, oh, we can use that and we'll just write new music to it. Like, we'll scratch what we had before and do a whole new chord progression that would match his vocals better or make his vocals sound better than they did. And so it ended up being this kind of puzzle. And so, you know, we took 2 years putting this one together, but all of that 2 years was mostly that kind of work.
Boy, this is really amazing. I mean, it's kind of eerie, this idea that in previous experiences of songwriting together, he was kind of paying tribute to the musicianship of the rest of you, because you had to get, as you put it, the landscape in place before he could add the lyrics to it. And now it's like you're giving him that gift back. You're treating the words as the landscape that you had to build music around.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was a completely new challenge for us as, you know, songwriters and producers. The only song on there, the last track, is called Muse. That's the last song that Andy had recorded everything all the way through on. But everything else was pieced together and painstakingly, you know, picked apart until we were happy with it.
That's fascinating just as a purely creative challenge. And it's also very moving as a friendship and artistic collaborator challenge. But it's also kind of remarkable to me because one of the things to me about the record is how consistent it sounds, not just musically, but thematically. Something that came up for me over and over again as I was listening to it was that it seemed like almost all of the songs are addressing this question of whether or not you can trust your feelings. We have lyrics like, "Tell me I'm okay. I hope you feel the same." There's a song called What You Live For that seems to me at least to be asking whether all these years of the struggles of trying to make it as a creative ensemble have been worth it. Is that a theme that you guys were addressing consciously, or is that just kind of a happy accident of this kind of fragmentary process?
You know, I think it was a happy accident, but obviously looking back, you're going to attach new meaning to it after he had passed. But it's too odd in some of them. Ooh, you really gotta believe me when I say you make it look easy. Ooh, pick me up when I'm broken. Ooh, look at us, we're coasting now. It's coming up when you need it. I'll show you off, you know, secret. Ooh, and they ain't gotta believe me. Ooh, and they ain't gotta believe me.
Well, Ryan Weddle is the bassist for Catastro. We've been talking about their new record, Until the End of Time. Catastro will be playing at the Marquee Theater tonight and tomorrow night, celebrating their 17 years of collaboration and friendship with former lead singer Andy Chavez. Ryan, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was great.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.